Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today I will be interviewing Professor Posner, Kirkland and Ellis, Distinguished Service Professor of Law, and Arthur and Esther Kane Research Chair at the University of Chicago Law School. His research interests include antitrust law, financial regulation, international law, and constitutional law. Before we get started, I wanted to say that I have a Patreon now where you can support the podcast and I can invest it back into the podcast with better equipment, content, and help with my passion for technology and public policy. My name is Ken Hinn, your host with The Robots Are Coming. Let's get started. So Professor Posner is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a member of the American Law Institute. And in today's episode, we are discussing his latest book, How Antitrust Failed Workers, in his seminal paper, The Political Economy of the Decline of Antitrust Enforcement in the U.S. Enforcement, August 2022. So the first question for you is, Professor, how has the use of antitrust law to counter market power in labor markets changed over time?
Antitrust law in the United States came into existence in 1890 in a statute called the Sherman Act. And the statute is written in very broad terms. It basically says that firms are not supposed to engage in anti-competitive behavior in any kind of market. And from a very early period, courts have interpreted that to mean any labor markets, product markets, and so on. But there are very few efforts to engage in antitrust enforcement in labor markets at the very beginning. And it's only in the last few years that enforcement efforts against employers who have engaged in anti-competitive behavior in labor markets has really ramped up. And really, the turning point might interest you, Ken, because of your interest in technology. The turning point was in 2010. And what happened then was that a number of the big Silicon Valley firms, including Apple and Google, were accused by the Justice Department of having engaged in the no-poach agreement. They had allegedly agreed not to challenge each other's sorry, to hire away each other's software engineers. And that kind of agreement not to compete for workers is an antitrust violation. The companies settled with the Justice Department. They also settled with the workers who sued them for several hundred million dollars. This case was a big surprise, I think, to people. They didn't think that these big companies, which were very sophisticated, had a lot of lawyers, would engage in such a blatant antitrust violation. And so the Justice Department and the FTC, another government agency, began to look more closely into the practices of employers. And so over the next number of years, they began to investigate. They brought some criminal cases and some civil cases as well. There had also been a number of private actions going back a number of years. But just in the last few years, there's been a lot of new academic work by economists who have discovered a great deal of anti-competitive behavior by employers. And so just, since maybe about 2017, 2018, there's been a lot of litigation. And I've gotten interested in this topic, and that's why I wrote the book that you mentioned.
You mentioned there being anti-competitive behavior by employers. What about anti-competitive behavior by giant corporations like Facebook and Google?
Well, so employers, so giant corporations are employers, and they're also simultaneously sellers. So, a single company will simultaneously operate in multiple markets. So, for example, if you take Google sells advertising. So its customers are, basically advertising agencies and other businesses. It also, you know, sells search to consumers, although the price is zero. So there it's facing consumers. It's in a consumer market. And it hires software engineers. So there it's operating in a labor market, right? And Facebook similarly. So these are enormous companies. And of course, Google and Facebook had engaged in anti-competitive behavior in labor markets back in 2010. That was the basis of this lawsuit. But I think you're referring to all of the discussion about Google, Facebook, and the other big tech firms, and whether they pose a serious problem for the economy because of their market power in all kinds of markets. So, as you know, over the last number of years, the government, private actors have been bringing lawsuits, launching investigations against these companies with mixed success. Sometimes these companies win, sometimes they lose. There's been a lot of foreign, a large number of foreign investigations and litigation as well. It's a little bit early to say, you know, how all of this is going to turn out. My own view is that they are extremely powerful monopolies. But, you know, the nature of their monopoly power is complicated, and what to do about it is complicated. The antitrust laws are one tool that can be used to challenge these companies, but it may also be the case that regulation of various types is a way of dealing with the challenges that they pose. You know, high prices in the ad market, for example, but there's also these concerns about data privacy and so on.
How do you expect the courts or the Department of Justice to measure the political power of such corporations like Google and Facebook?
Well, in antitrust litigation, generally speaking, political power is not really an issue, which is an interesting fact and something that a lot of people are concerned about. The antitrust laws, you know, back in the 19th century and the laws that were enacted in the early 20th century were motivated in part by concern about the political power of monopolies. So, for example, the Section 7 of the Clayton Act, which prohibits mergers that substantially lessen competition, can be understood in part as a way of preventing firms from obtaining so much power that they could influence political outcomes, for example, by lobbying or bribing legislatures and so forth. But today, especially because of the First Amendment, agencies and courts and even, you know, the legislatures, they're a little bit wary about enforcing the laws against corporations based on concerns about their political power. That would raise First Amendment concerns. So, but on the other hand, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, there's no other way, you know, this is a good way of trying to deal with these companies. And, you know, there's a lot of debate going on at the moment, but I think it's fair to say that the law isn't used against these companies based on their political power, that their political power doesn't play a role in the enforcement of the law.
What about the ability of big corporations like Google and Facebook to suppress wages? Is that an issue as well?
So in the 2010 litigation, I told you about Google was accused of that. You know, Google and Apple and Pixar and a number of companies were the argument was that they had suppressed wages by using a no poaching agreement. whether, you know, I'm not aware of anybody alleging today that Google suppresses wages or that Facebook does. But there are, you know, there are a lot of allegations made that other corporations have suppressed wages. There's been a lot of academic work that shows that, for example, franchises have used no poach agreements, possibly as a way of suppressing wages. There's been a lot of work that shows the covenants not to compete, which are agreements under which employees agree not to work for competitors of their former employers, that those are overused and suppress wages. There are a number of cases in which various firms have been accused of entering into agreements to fix wages or not to poach each other's workers. I'm not sure. I'm off the top of my head, I don't think these cases involve big tech companies. They involve other types of companies, but it's still, you know, it's still a big problem.
I mean, it is a big problem, but aren't these employees free to find better jobs?
No, that's the problem. Is that if a firm has, you know, let's say you're a software engineer, and you know you live in you know, California, and you have your family there, and you know you can't, as a practical matter, move to another part of the country. And let's suppose your skills are valued by the local big tech companies or small tech companies, Facebook, Google, Yelp, whoever. And all of those companies get together and agree not to pay you more than a certain amount of money. You know, you could be a barista, you could work in a restaurant, you know, maybe you could become an accountant. You could find a job. It's not like they can prevent you from working, period. But you can't actually use, you know, your skills. You know, if you're an expert coder, you're not able to use those skills. Or if you are, I mean, maybe you could code for a bakery or something that wants a website. You're not actually using your skills in their highest and best use. So that's an economic harm. That's bad for the economy and bad for you. So that's the nature of the harm. It's both a economic harm and it's a harm to the person. It's just the same as it's just the same as why we're concerned about monopoly on the side of, you know, on the seller side. So if a bunch of car companies get together and agree to raise the price of automobiles, you know, people can still buy automobiles. They just have to pay more. If they can't afford it, you know, you can buy a motorcycle or a bicycle or a scooter, but you're worse off because what you really need is an automobile. So that's the nature of the harm in both cases.
Isn't there also the nature of the harm for these companies to undercut potential rivals with lower prices?
I'm sorry,
they could undercut their rivals.
Tend to think that's good. So the market economy, we want firms to compete. The way they compete is by lowering prices. And in product markets, the way they compete is they lower prices. And in theory, they keep lowering prices until price equals the marginal cost of production. And in labor markets, the way they compete is by raising wages. And they keep raising wages until wages equal the marginal revenue product of their workers. It's exactly symmetrical. And the nice thing about this, at least according to economists, is that in product markets, as prices go down to the cost of production, more people can buy things, so they're made better off. And in labor markets, as wages go up, more people will enter the market so that they'll do more work. And while this is complicated, you know, generally speaking, as more people enter the market, more stuff will be produced. So as more stuff is produced, there's more of it, which means its price will go down. So that's, you know, that's generally what we expect in competitive markets. And the antitrust laws are in place in order to prevent firms from undermining competitive markets. When firms undermine competitive markets, they prevent this competitive mechanism, which reduces output, that harms workers and consumers, who, by the way, are normally the same people, resulting in a transfer of their wealth to the people who own the corporations.
I want to discuss something that isn't in your book just yet, and that's the shift towards artificial intelligence with new companies like OpenAI, Microsoft, which are writing papers and doing better than some law school students. How do you think antitrust law is going to change?
Not better than my law students.
How do you think that antitrust laws will be changing over time as OpenAI advances and this technology advances?
I mean, you know, I think, like, at an abstract level, it's in a way nothing new, because technology has been improving, you know, for hundreds of years. And as technology improves, what it does is it always displaces some, you know, some earlier type of labor or some earlier type of technology that is mixed with labor to produce some kind of outcome, right? So when the car displaces the horse and buggy, certain people lose their jobs. The people who, you know, manufacture buggy whips, and the people who take care of horses, and the people who drive the horses and buggies, I suppose. And then other people get jobs, the people who manufacture cars. And that causes a shock. So there's certainly going to be some hardship as a result. Some people are going to lose their jobs. Maybe they'll be able to move to these new jobs. Other people will get these new jobs. Over the, you know, medium to long run, people are generally better off, because with the new technology, output goes up, you know, and there's more stuff for people. So it's, you know, generally an okay thing. The connection with antitrust is, you know, there's not really a direct connection with antitrust. When technology changes, it can create, it can affect market structure, meaning the optimal number of firms in the market, which can create problems. And in fact, we've seen this with tech. Tech seems to, you know, the modern tech era seems to favor very big firms that are able to produce networks, and that gives them monopoly power. So, you know, that has to be dealt with legally, and antitrust law is one of the tools that do that. So now let's take, you know, the artificial intelligence. So right now there are a lot of people, let's take lawyers, but, you know, it could be accountants or software engineers or so forth. I think at least in the short term, I don't think they're all going to be replaced by algorithms, although they could be. But at least I think in the short term, what's going to happen is, you know, my life, the lawyer's life, is going to become a little easier, because, you know, this algorithm is probably going to write a first draft of my brief for me. And so it's a little bit like the typewriter being replaced by a word processor. So now I don't have to write the first draft. The algorithm writes the first draft, and then I probably edit it pretty heavily so it's not stupid. But, you know, I save some time. And that's going to make lawyers more productive, which means they're going to be paid more. But it might also mean that we won't need as many lawyers. It's possible. It's hard to tell, though, because, you know, it might also make legal services cheaper. I mean, these things can have all kinds of complicated effects. It's possible that we'll need fewer lawyers, or that law firms will become bigger. For whatever reason, because maybe the AI is super expensive. So you have to have like a really big law firm with a really big computer. And that means there's going to be very few law firms. And then each law firm is going to have a lot more market power. And, you know, maybe we'll need antitrust law to control law firms. And that's the kind of complicated chain of events that you have to think about. But even if it were more extreme, I don't think, you know, that would change things very much. Imagine, for example, that lawyers are completely replaced with algorithms. All right, so there are no more lawyers. All the lawyers have to find new jobs. And just let's imagine, for example, that they have to retrain, and they become, I don't know, some of them retire, some of them, I don't know, they become like, I don't know, they become home healthcare workers. Like, you know, suppose like, you know, elderly people who need home healthcare workers. They don't want algorithms. They don't want robots. They want human beings. So all these lawyers become home healthcare workers. Okay, I'm sure they're not going to be terribly happy about this. But there they are, right? We have a lot of home healthcare workers. They're not going to be paid very much because there's a huge supply, and they're probably not very good at it because they're former lawyers, not known for their, you know, their compassion. But you know, so what? And now the, you know, the law industry, I mean, it's just software, right? So it could be that a single company owns these algorithms, you know, and licenses it to anybody who needs to have a will drafted or bring a lawsuit, you know. And if it's a single company, it has a monopoly, or maybe there are four companies and they might collude, right? So then we need antitrust law for that. But maybe there'll be 1,000 companies, all of them competing vigorously to get other, you know, various people to buy, to license their algorithms. And then we have a great competitive market, and legal services will be supplied at their marginal cost, and it'll be a fantastic world with everybody suing each other and not paying very much, and justice will be done. So, like, you know, that's the future world. Antitrust law, you know, I think will be the least of our worries. It'll be, you know, it'll be there in the background. Of course, the algorithms themselves will be bringing the antitrust cases. Got to think about that as well. But the you know, I think, you know, we'll be thinking about other things, like how do we govern this mess. But I think antitrust law is like not going to be the biggest deal.
Well, that's a whole lot of speculation for the future, and then that sounds right out of HBO's Silicon Valley. So
or the Black Mirror, maybe.
Yeah, sure. The next thing I want to move on to is your paper, professor, on the political economy of the decline of antitrust enforcement in the U.S., and it's a working paper. And in that paper, you talk about antitrust and enforcement, and you discuss extensively about the decline of antitrust enforcement in the United States and hypothesize some of the reasons for the decline of antitrust enforcement. And according to your paper, your working paper, what led to the decline of antitrust enforcement in the United States?
Right. So first, let me mention my co-authors, Filippo Lancieri and Luigi Zingales. And our argument is that business interests played a big role. And what's distinctive about our thesis is that I think the conventional wisdom is that the decline of antitrust enforcement was the result of like a policy judgment, like a kind of an honest policy judgment made by government officials that was driven by intellectual evolution. Okay, so let me expand on that a bit. I think the conventional wisdom is that, you know, in 1890, you know, when Congress first passes the antitrust law, the Sherman Act, you know, it's driven by kind of populism and general panic and craziness, and that this extends through, you know, much of the 20th century. People don't understand economics very well, at least the people in power. The Supreme Court gets its hands on the antitrust law and, you know, doesn't understand economics and issues these confusing judicial opinions that just make a mess of things. And so by the 1960s, we've got this crazy, confusing antitrust law that paradoxically actually hurts people, you know, and protects inefficient businesses and is just a terrible mess. And in the 1960s, maybe a little earlier, but sort of basically the 1960s, economists, and usually the Chicago School is given credit or blame depending on your, you know, perspective, but also in truth, Harvard, people at Harvard figured out that these Supreme Court cases were, you know, brainless, that economics was the tool that was needed to understand antitrust law. And that once you apply economics, you realize that that you know, the rules of antitrust law should actually be, you know, relatively simple. And so these economists and law professors after them started writing papers. These papers got a lot of attention. Eventually, the Supreme Court noticed them. The Supreme Court changed the rules. The antitrust agencies, the Department of Justice, the FTC, you know, were influenced as well. And then over time, the impact of these changes was to reduce antitrust enforcement. Okay. Now, there's little doubt that antitrust enforcement has declined. I think there's a growing consensus that that was unfortunate, because there's a lot of evidence now that market concentration is increasing, prices are increasing, you know, prices minus costs, or what are called margins or markups, are increasing, and various other bad things are happening. I should say that there's controversy about this, but I think, you know, the consensus, the growing, the I don't know, most people think that, you know, there's been over-enforcement, under-enforcement, but that this was kind of a mistake, and now people are kind of waking up to this mistake, and that's the story. The view in our paper is that, and I should say that this mistake was, you know, sort of broad-based, that, you know, back in the 1970s, free market economics was in its ascendancy, and this view that this sort of 1960s view of antitrust law was inconsistent with that. So there was like this kind of general view that we had to cut back on antitrust enforcement. It was being used improperly to interfere with the free market rather than to protect it. So basically what we argue in our paper is that what really happened was that the public never, you know, sort of never gave up its enthusiasm for antitrust enforcement. And I, you know, I don't think populism is a terribly helpful term here. I think, you know, the public in this country has always been a little wary of big business. I mean, people like, you know, products, you know, the goods and services that businesses produce. The US is a very commercial society, but people have always been pretty skeptical of big business, partly because of political influence and partly because of scandals and so on and so forth. But the public never, you know, sort of openly said to the government, we want you to cut down on antitrust law. And interestingly, you know, this is in pretty significant contrast to the public's attitude toward taxes and deregulation. So in the 1970s, there was a backlash to high taxes and to high levels of regulation. You know, Ronald Reagan famously ran on a platform of cutting taxes and regulation, and the public, you know, voted him in office. And even before Reagan, Jimmy Carter, a Democratic president, began deregulating the economy. So it's not like, you know, the US public didn't care about economic policy, but neither Reagan nor Carter, or really any other president, said, you know, we want to get rid of antitrust law, or we wanted to reduce enforcement of antitrust law. So the reduction of antitrust law happened in the shadows. So why did it happen? Well, you know, the Chicago School and the Harvard School, you know, these ideas weren't irrelevant, but they weren't enough by themselves. And so our argument is it was really most likely the influence of business, lobbying behind the scenes, lobbying Congress, lobbying the agencies, and influencing courts. And we try to document this with publicly available data and, you know, things like hearings, transcripts of the hearings of nominees to the agencies and so forth. So that's the overall point of the paper.
the paper, which falls under the Chicago School of Antitrust, doesn't provide the most effective means, some argue, of regulating antitrust laws. There's has been some criticism for its narrow focus on consumer welfare for failing to consider the broader implications of antitrust law, such as its potential to create more market power and reduce competition. What's your response to that, Professor?
I'm sorry, this is a criticism of our paper or a criticism of the Chicago School?
The Chicago School in general.
The Chicago School. So one of the, probably the leading member of the Chicago School, Robert Bork, argued that the purpose of antitrust law was to advance consumer welfare. And, you know, basically, you know, the criticism of that was that, first of all, that's not, you know, true, just as a historical matter. The purpose of antitrust law was to counter market competition. You know, it was to counter market concentration, basically to counter big corporations, to prevent companies from becoming massive monopolies, and to prevent, you know, cartels and that sort of thing. So Bork wanted to narrow and simplify this original goal of kind of constraining big business into this kind of consumer welfare. As a practical matter, you know, what this meant was that, for example, if you're evaluating a merger, let's say two companies want to merge. Let's say they're both, I don't know, coal mining companies. Let's say they're both big, they mine a lot of coal, they sell it, you know. The way Bork, well, actually Bork didn't really think this way, but one modern way of looking at this is just to say, well, if they merge, is the price of coal going to go up or not? And if it's going to go up, we want to block the merger. And if it's going to go down, the merger is fine, right? That's kind of like a way of thinking about it. And all that you're looking at is the impact on what an economist would call consumer surplus, or loosely consumer welfare. But, you know, the kind of the original way of thinking about this would be, you know, the real reason why we might be concerned about this merger is that these two coal companies, if they merge, they become like this gigantic, massive coal company that, you know, it may or may not raise prices, but it's going to, you know, lobby the government to relax pollution regulations. And it's going to, I don't know, put on commercials to support some particular political candidate. And, you know, it might, you know, bust the union and underpay the workers and, you know, just hassle people. And maybe, you know, just make life more difficult for us because it's just so big and powerful. So so Bork just said, who cares about that stuff? It's kind of vague. And you know, I think the Bork's critics are right that for two reasons. Like, the first reason is, you know, we live in a democracy. The public is uneasy with big business, and Congress tried to implement this public view. And this public view, you know, has remained consistent for like more than a century.
And the next question I have for you, Professor, is how did you get interested in antitrust law?
Well, I started off when I started teaching, I wasn't interested in antitrust law at all. I was interested in commercial law and contract law and a bunch of other things. And part of the reason why I wasn't interested in antitrust law, this was in the 1990s, was that the field seemed kind of dead. There was a bit of a consensus, I think, about how antitrust law should be understood at the time. And, you know, in the 1990s, the economy seemed to be doing very well. And there was everybody was happy, at least compared to now. But in the, I don't know, about 10 years ago or so, I was working on various things with my friend Glenn Weil, who's an economist and an expert on industrial organization, which is the economist's word or field for the area of economics that corresponds to antitrust. It's about how industry is organized. And he was quite persuaded that industry was not organized well, that there was too much market power in lots of different areas of the economy. And we started working on some ideas. Now Glenn's views were, you know, fairly off the beaten path. He was concerned, for example, about how anyone, you know, just, you know, all of us, just by virtue of owning sort of non-fungible goods, have market power. Like if you own a house, houses are not identical to other houses, so you have market power over your house. And that's why it often takes a very long time to sell a house. And so the, you know, this type of market power can cause distortions in the economy and inefficiencies. So we wrote about this topic, but as we were writing, he kept pointing out to me that there was this growing economic literature about other types of often more conventional types of anti-competitive behavior and collusion. And the first literature he pointed me to was this really interesting and quite, you know, striking literature on institutional investors. A bunch of guys, well, I shouldn't say guys, because it was Jose Azar, Martin Schmaltz, and Isabel Teiku. They wrote a paper about the airlines industry. They found that when institutional investors, these are like these big companies like BlackRock and Vanguard, obtain larger stakes in the airlines, ticket prices went up. So institutional investors, you know, they don't run the airlines, they just own stakes in the airlines, but they're the biggest owners of these airlines. And the theory was that as the airlines, you know, the airlines were thinking, the people who ran the airlines were thinking, you know, we have common owners, which means those owners have an interest in us, you know, not raising our, raising our prices and colluding rather than competing with each other. So this was a controversial paper, but it spawned this enormous literature as it suggested that the U.S. economy, indeed the global economy, was highly inefficient. It actually had roots in these sort of concerns about corporate consolidation going back decades or even centuries. This worry that capital would all end up in the hands of a very small number of people. Although in this case, a small number of institutions. So there's still a lot of discussion about this problem, although it's veered off in various different directions. And it was also Glenn who drew my attention to these recent papers about labor markets. And that's how I got interested in the problem of labor monopsony.
And where do you see antitrust progressing over time? I know I had a previous interview with Professor Messer on the happiness and the law. So where do you see it progressing from there, and how do you view antitrust?
So I think what's interesting right now in antitrust law is that this view that antitrust enforcement has been too weak over the last few decades is fairly broad. It's not just, you know, the far left or even the not so far left or even just the left. I think there's some on the right who agree with that. The view on the right is complicated because some of the support for antitrust enforcement on the right reflects this kind of newfound distrust for big business because companies like Facebook, for example, you know, seem to reflect this sort of liberal or left-wing ideology. And people on the right are worried that these organizations are kind of imposing these values onto consumers. So I'm not sure how much overlap there is here, but there does seem to be new energy drawing from both you know, sides of the political spectrum in favor of antitrust enforcement. And so I think that in Congress and the executive branch, and maybe even the private bar, you know, there's something like, and in the academy, there's something like a movement toward greater antitrust enforcement. And the real question is the judiciary. I think the judiciary has become, you know, quite anti-antitrust, quite conservative about antitrust law, quite skeptical about antitrust arguments. There's some pockets of enthusiasm about antitrust law in the judiciary, but there's a kind of pervasive skepticism. And that skepticism is really the result of the Supreme Court, which has been you know, pushing against antitrust enforcement for the last 50 years. There's a little bit of a hint that maybe some of the Supreme Court justices are beginning to rethink this this skepticism, but it's too early to tell. The Supreme Court doesn't get many antitrust cases. That is, they don't, you know, they don't consider many antitrust cases. But you know, it's just a little too early to tell. But if the courts remain hostile to antitrust, nothing's going to change unless there's significant legislation. And I don't think that's likely in the near future. So, you know, we'll have to see. But I do think the agencies will be aggressive in the near term. And they may be, and I think they'll be imaginative also, which I think will be a good thing. So I'm pretty optimistic that there will be interesting times ahead.
There will be interesting times ahead, indeed. And it's interesting that you mentioned the judiciary, because there's two sides that the Supreme Court has taken in comparison to the courts, the Taft Court and the Warren Court. Taft wanted more of a limited government intervention, and that meant less antitrust, that limited the scope of antitrust laws, whereas Earl Warren wanted to prevent the concentration of economic power. So what would be the consequences? What were the consequences of each of their courts, and what does the court look like today?
Well, I mean, there's been, you know, there's been a kind of cycling on the Supreme Court. I'd say the Supreme Court has generally been hostile to antitrust law. I mean, from the very beginning, the Supreme Court was hostile. It wasn't just under Taft. I think most people think the Supreme Court undermined the Sherman Act of 1890. And, you know, the Warren Court was very aggressive, as you said. And then starting in the 1970s, the Supreme Court began to restrict antitrust law again. And it's been doing that consistently since then. So that's, more than 40 years. And it's, yes, it's been consistently hostile to antitrust law. Really starting in the mid to late 70s and, consistently through the 80s and the 90s. And it's just in the last couple of years where there's been some, although not certainly not consistently, but, just a couple cases where there was, some suggestion that the court would be a bit more friendly to plaintiffs. So, for example, in a case called NCAA versus Alston, this was a case involving, this was actually a labor monopsony case involving the NCAA. The court was pretty clear that, if a bunch of teams collude to pay athletes nothing, that's a potential antitrust violation. That would be obvious, normally be obvious, but the court, at least it said that, and Justice Kavanaugh in a concurrence made a pretty clear statement to that effect. And, that's helpful. It's good that they didn't do the opposite. But we just have to wait and see. I mean, there are other ways that, as a practical matter, have been very, quite devastating to antitrust cases. For example, the court has been very adamant about enforcing arbitration clauses. So it's very difficult for consumers or workers to bring antitrust cases because firms can just protect themselves by using arbitration clauses, which prevent class actions, as a result of which lawyers cannot, as a financial matter, bring these cases. And then, there are other things that the court has done. It's made it difficult to sue platforms. It's, raised standards of proof. Just all these things, often they're very minor seeming, but collectively, the courts have made it hard, very hard. The Supreme Court has made it very hard for plaintiffs to bring these cases.
It's interesting that you bring up the NCAA versus Alston case, because back in 1976, the Warren Court challenged the NCAA's restrictions on the compensation of college football players, and the NCAA's rules were subject to the scrutiny under antitrust laws, and the restrictions on player compensation may have been anti-competitive. And with the changing in the makeup of the Supreme Court now to what it is in 2021, there may be a change and a shift towards that case. What do you think would happen if there's a reversal of the NCAA versus Alston case, if there has been any so far?
Well, there's not going to be a reversal of the case. I mean, the Supreme Court just decided it and can't be reversed. So, I mean, the Supreme Court didn't, it's the courts have maintained a pretty consistent line about these sports league cases. It's just that some of the, what lawyers call dicta, some of the language that the courts use in explaining why they come to the results that they do has been helpful recently. That's all that I mean.
And my next question is, what is next for antitrust laws, and what you think future entrepreneurs, policymakers, people in the future should be knowing about antitrust laws as time goes on? And do you have any upcoming work that is going to be used to address some of the upcoming changes in both technology, public policy, and so forth?
Well, I think, I think tech is going to continue to be a big challenge for antitrust law. I think there, so tech is changing all the time. And, you brought up you brought up artificial intelligence. And one thing that, you know, one thing people have been talking about is algorithmic collusion, for example. So, you know, in the old days, you know, if two gas stations wanted to collude, they're across the street from each other, you know, the gas station owners could talk to each other, you know, let's set the price at $4 a gallon. That's illegal. They could go to jail, or they could just watch, you know, how they, you know, change the signs and mirror each other. And that's not illegal, but, you know, maybe that's harder to do. Today, you know, a bunch of online stores can just use algorithms, and they could just tell their algorithms to maximize their, you know, their profits or their revenues, and not even tell the algorithms to, you know, collude. But the algorithms could figure out by themselves that they should collude, you know, that they should look at the prices, they should search the web and look at the prices that other algorithms are setting and mirror those prices and so on and so forth. And so, you know, trying to deal with that using antitrust law is going to be, you know, a big topic, I think, in the future. If you let companies do that, you know, prices are going to go up. But it's not clear, you know, how antitrust law should be used to address that problem. Maybe some kind of regulation will work. You know, I don't know. This is something that people have been writing about. I think it's interesting, but I think it's not so much this particular issue that's in the future, although, you know, it will be, but just that technology is going to continue to advance and create these problems for markets. Because markets don't work if commercial actors are able to collude with each other. So, you know, the broader problem is whether technology makes collusion easier. And I think, you know, in the recent past, our worry was more about, do tech markets make monopoly easier, in the sense that, you know, these platforms seem to be really essential in these tech markets, and someone's going to end up with the platform that has most of the customers, and that someone's going to have market power, which is going to allow that someone to charge high prices and to engage in manipulation and to extend that market power into different markets and on and on and on. But artificial intelligence and, you know, various types of algorithms and so forth might suggest that even the companies that don't have platforms are going to be able to figure out ways to collude without, you know, breaking the existing antitrust rules in any kind of obvious ways. And that's just as bad. So yeah, I think the tech world, I mean, people have already understand, like, tech just is really hard. Standard setting has always been a problem, right? We want tech companies to use common standards. But, you know, once we agree that there's got to be a common standard, there are all kinds of incentives for firms to engage in, you know, manipulation in order to be, you know, in order to ensure that the standard over which they have a patent becomes the common standard. And the government gets involved to try to, like, referee these disputes, and maybe it does a reasonably good job, maybe it doesn't. So I do feel, I think there's a sense that we're at one of these inflection points with AI where there's going to be a sudden burst or acceleration in technology, and we need to keep an eye on, you know, the impact. Is it because, you know, there's this mix of excitement and dread, but, you know, the excitement and dread is about, you know, is AI going to allow, you know, is it going to, you know, allow me to, so as a law professor, the excitement is, oh, you know, maybe I can just have a computer program, you know, write my next book for me while I take a nap. That would be great. And the dread is, you know, maybe I'll be fired. Like, maybe I'm not going to have a job because some computer is going to write all my next books. So why pay me? That's the excitement and dread, right? But the reality might be that the excitement is, well, maybe GDP is going to increase a little bit and people are going to be a little bit more comfortable because technology is improving in, you know, very hard to notice ways, but real ways, you know, all this behind the scenes tech is going to make maybe, you know, our food a little cheaper and our shelter a little cheaper. We'll have more savings. We'll be a little more comfortable. That's good. But the bad side, the possible bad side is actually what the tech's going to do is make everything a little bit more expensive because all of these companies will find it easier to collude on prices. And that strikes me as, you know, just as possible. So we'll just have to see. And if that does happen, I guess we'll need a bigger, you know, bigger antitrust agencies to somehow stop this from happening.
Well, I can attest that here in the Silicon Valley, food is a lot more expensive. Housing is a lot more expensive, but also wages or salaries for you know, high paying jobs are a little bit higher. So there's a balancing agent there. I remember I was out in the Midwest and I couldn't believe I could get that much food for such low money. So so there will be definitely a need for different forms of antitrust in the future as more people get their hands to better technology, because frankly, I think the rest of the country is a little bit more behind on technology, but there's gonna be more to come. But thank you, Professor, for having this wonderful conversation. Is there anything else you want to say about your upcoming book, how viewers can purchase your book or how
we can get it? The book is not upcoming. It was published last year, I think, but you can get it on Amazon or any other monopolist.
Got it. Well, thank you for listening to this podcast, everyone on The Robots Are Coming.
Well, I should say you can get it on Amazon and no other company. Right. That's
yeah, absolutely. I completely understand Amazon monopoly. So next time we'll have more professors speaking on more topics of public policy and technology. So make sure you subscribe to The Robots Are Coming wherever you're listening to. We currently are not a monopolist yet. We are very much very competitive podcast that's making around $4. So please subscribe and tell all your friends to do that as well. All right. Thanks.